Blog Talk Radio.
Saturday, 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, and you're listening to you with your host, Avenger Satanus, and the Beast.
Hey, thanks for tuning in. I'm T.C. Downey, and this is my co-host, Avenger Satanus. Avenger, how you doing, man?
I'm doing okay. How you doing?
I'm doing all right. I might be doing pretty good. We'll see how things go, but... I think I'm doing all right now, at the very least, so.
That's good.
Yeah.
Well, the book on Gurdjieff that I had ordered over a week ago from Amazon never arrived, so. I don't know. So, research mode did not go as planned, but I'll try to not bring the side down.
Well, don't worry, man. I started about a week ago trying to tackle The Herald of Coming Good, which was written by Gurdjieff, and I never made it through the 87 pages of it. I got most of the way through it, but life takes its twists and turns, and, well, at the end of it all, you know, I guess I'd come up shorthanded myself, so.
So how did you find it?
I downloaded it, the PDF off of the internet.
I mean, how did you find the book? I mean, what did you think of it?
What I've read so far? Well, once you get used to the language that Gurdjieff's using, and I'm assuming that it's an English translation, so that's probably why it takes a little bit to get acclimated to the language that Gurdjieff is using. I thought the book was overall very fascinating, at least as much as I've gotten through. One of the things that I immediately found interesting about the book was that in the very beginning, he says that, you know, he doesn't, he doesn't think it's right that he charges for the book, but on the other hand, he has to, you know, the people who publish the book have to, make a penny. So he pretty much puts it up to where you can decide how much you want to pay. He gives you two options in the book. I'm trying to remember what it was. It's like 8 francs and then on until whatever it was, 200 francs or something like that was the most that he would allow to be charged for the book. And what he says is, no matter what you paid for it, he wants you to fill out this what's the term used for it?
Questionnaire?
It's sort of a questionnaire. It's more like a registry. Yeah, it's a registration. And the book's actually numbered. It asks you, you know, the name of the purchaser, the address, how you acquired it, you know, if you acquired it accidentally or on advice. And then if on advice, give name and address, and then he asks for the sum paid, and that's all.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, his only real request made in terms of the book goes, but... I can definitely see that this is during the earlier parts of his career as a writer.
Okay.
A lot of things that I would consider to be very Gurdjieff haven't quite surfaced at this point, as far as I can tell from the book. However, he does state that it's one of many in a series of instructions, so perhaps it's just because I haven't gotten past the first book and into the other ones, and I'll see later on how it all ties in.
Okay. Well, for those who may be listening or don't know, just very briefly, Gurdjieff, he was mostly around in the, I guess, the 19th, 20th century, and he brought what is known as the Fourth Way, or the work, to Western civilization, and it's an esoteric kind of philosophy or psychology or religion that tries to transform man into what he is, which is kind of a machine and a prisoner of the illusions all around us, into someone conscious, someone trying to work on, becoming better or, a superior version, to transcend all the, the mundane crap and non-essential bullshit that takes place in our lives. So, if anyone wants to call in and talk about Gurdjieff, they should go right ahead. The number's on the Blog Talk Radio page for the news. I guess I can share it here. 347-989-1371. That's the number. So feel free to call in. I see here, I'm just kind of glancing at Gurdjieff's sites on the web. Talking about the Fourth Way, it is, as Gurdjieff declared, completely self-supporting and independent of other lines, and it has been completely unknown up to the present time. Now, that's kind of a bold statement, and if DC will indulge me, I thought maybe we could talk about that.
I would certainly indulge you. I do need to grab this other phone real quick, though. So,
okay. Go ahead. I will speak in your stead. So it's self-supporting. That means it doesn't need any other little bits or any other structures, or it doesn't need any buttressing of other schools, other philosophies, other religions to make it happen. It's its own thing. And I think that's pretty important. I mean, a lot of, Christianity and Buddhism, like that, I guess they're self-supporting too. So maybe that's not such a great claim, because a lot of different teachings are self-supporting. But he says that it's completely unknown up to the present time. I assume he means that it was unknown to the world at large, because someone must have known it. It must have been carried down to either oral traditions or, various esoteric writing, or I don't know, maybe taught through visions and dreams and such by the ancient ones. Who knows? Clicking on Gurdjieff, the early years. Of Greek and Armenian parentage, G.I. Gurdjieff was born and grew up in the volatile Caucasus region, located between Christian Orthodox Russia and Islamic Turkey, Iraq, and Persia. The date of his birth remains in question. More logical than 1866, the date usually given is 1872. Both Olga de Hartmann, the woman Gurdjieff called first friend of my inner life, and Louise Kopfert March, Gurdjieff's secretary in the early 30s, believed that Gurdjieff was born in 1872. Okay. His family moved from Alexandropol, present-day Gürmiye, to Kars shortly after his recapture by Russia from the Turks, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, Gurdjieff grew up in a very chaotic time, and there was a lot of war and foreign and civil tensions, revolution going on. Things were changing. The world was coming to a wholly different place. And I think this became a good backdrop for his teaching.
Totally agree with you there, man. As a matter of fact, I think that that whole turmoil in the section of the world that he was living in is not only a surmountable point as to why he was driven to, go after and in search of these great mysteries. I guess when hell is all around you, and it's in your everyday life, you search hard and you search fast for a little bit of bliss that you can get as a man.
Yes. Also, it seemed like Gurdjieff was mostly unfazed by all the little hiccups and obstacles and distractions throughout his life. And I think that's an important part of the work, too, is that you got to be yourself and remember yourself, be mindful of everything without being caught up in the drama of life, and you got to separate yourself from yourself and the rest of the world. And that's really hard to do when you're being distracted by all these little bells and whistles, shiny objects in your peripheral vision. Him growing up in wartime and revolution time and chaos and things like that, he probably learned how to not be distracted by various obstacles and things getting in his way, because there's always going to be something. So, you can't properly work and understand the teaching, in a quiet room all your life. You've got to actually be able to utilize it in life itself, which is very chaotic and very volatile. So, yeah.
Awesome. I got to completely, once again, agree with you there.
How dare you? Thank you. Yes. That was a joke.
I got it. I just... I'm trying to catch my brain up myself to where I can figure out what it was that you wanted me to indulge you in prior to
actually wasn't that great. Don't worry about it.
One of the most amazing things about Gurdjieff was his magnetic personality. He just seemed to draw everybody into him.
Yeah.
One particular person was Ouspensky, and then there was another guy named Bennett that was really into him as well. And I mean, sure, there were dozens of others. Matter of fact, Ouspensky, and I'm trying to remember what the name of the movie was that I saw, but I saw a film that was, from a narrative perspective, supposed to be Ouspensky and his description of his encounter with Gurdjieff. And anyway, from the way he described it, even when Gurdjieff first returned back from the East with these new philosophies, Gurdjieff was never shy of at least 30 or 40 people at all times around him listening to him. So he was a modern-day Dalai Lama or Jesus Christ.
Yeah, I would agree. This is interesting. I'm quoting from a website called Gurdjieff-legacy.org. Okay. And this is, Gurdjieff introduces the teaching of the fourth way to the West. Recognizing that humanity had entered a precarious period and that the West needed a major shock not to destroy itself, Gurdjieff took a vow to introduce and establish the teaching of the fourth way in the West. he took a special oath on September 14, 1911, binding him for 21 years to lead in some ways an artificial life, modeled upon a program which had been previously planned in accordance with certain definite principles. So, yeah, Gurdjieff dedicated himself to teaching what it was that he found in the different parts of the world that he visited. And, yeah, he spread it to different people like Ouspensky and Nicol and De Hartman and, Bennett, a whole host of different people. And then they sort of spread it in their own way to different lands, like England and America and France, things like that.
I don't know if you're aware of this, but towards the end of Gurdjieff's life, him and Ouspensky actually weren't working together anymore. Something had transpired, and I'm not really sure as to what it was, but Ouspensky apparently didn't agree with the direction that Gurdjieff was going any longer, and he felt that he had the tools to take what he had learned and make something better.
Right. Or just teach it in a different way, using pretty much the same underlying principles, but I guess putting his own spin on it. I think that was kind of necessary for him to do that, and I've heard or I've read that this was all part of Gurdjieff's master plan, because that's what he wanted. He wanted Ouspensky to go out and do his own thing, and so he kind of masterminded this rift or this alienation between them, where Ouspensky would be able to leave his master and then go out into the world as a master himself and then create new disciples to carry on and spread the work. I don't know if that's true, but I've read that, I think, a couple different times from different sources. So
that is sort of the underlying hint that you're getting that film that I'm talking about. I'm desperately trying to jump onto YouTube right now to find the name of that film. So
okay. Yeah, there's a few different Gurdjieff things on YouTube. Then there's a lot of books. There are more books written about him, I think, than books written
by him.
More books written about him in the fourth way than books written by him. He taught a lot, but I don't think he wrote, a ton of stuff. And the things he did write, like Beelzebub's Tales to His Grandson, things like that, are more, I don't know, they seem more metaphorical or more allegory and parable and less direct teaching, which is what Ouspensky did. Ouspensky is more like a hands-on field manual of, like, what to do and different diagrams and, you got to do this and then do this. It's very straightforward. Where Gurdjieff was more, esoteric or more magical about it. He had this weird mystique about him. I think he tried to create that. It certainly gave him more power, as it did give him more mystery and more people wanted to know what he was about. Different ways of teaching and different ways of going about it. Do you have a personal opinion on Gurdjieff or his approach to others?
I believe that Gurdjieff was probably the only person who fully understood that what he was trying to teach. And although Ouspensky was one of the ones that stayed with him the longest, I still think he didn't maybe have an entire grasp upon what Gurdjieff's insight into it was, you know, he took small portions or even large portions, rather, of what Gurdjieff was teaching, and he tried to apply his own methods of understanding to it. And Bennett did the same thing, which is why if you, you know, get into anything either of the two of them have written, you'll find that even at one point in time, the cross parallel and then they come back around and separate. And when they separate, they go in extreme directions. As a matter of fact, so extreme that at the next point that they parallel, Ouspensky actually took legal action against Bennett, claiming that he was, I'm trying to remember exactly how this goes. He was claiming that he was actually trying to take credit for Gurdjieff's intellectual work. I mean, it's really fascinating when you look back at the actual development of the fourth way, as far as in terms of us receiving it in the West goes, because there are many great teachers, all having learned from the man themselves, or the man himself, and none of them actually. They all have this key kind of, I'm trying to think, they're not carbon copies, they're not duplicates, right. They're very individualized according to the perception of the person that was intaking the message as it was being delivered.
Right, and I think that's good to a certain degree. I think when something becomes just a carbon copy, it becomes less relatable to certain individuals because everybody's different. Everybody takes in knowledge differently, and everybody, you know, has different high points and, you know, flaws and merits and things like that. Also, at some point, I wanted to talk about, you know, do people... Some people, I guess, would consider Gurdjieff like, you know, obviously he's you know, a master of the fourth way and things like that. But, you know, is he worthy of being called, you know, some sort of living god or, you know, sort of walking on water, you know, amongst us? Or was he just a man, I mean, with his own flaws and his own idiosyncrasies? Did he make mistakes occasionally, or you know, is he as close to a perfect being as, you know, since the life and times of Jesus Christ, or, you know, or other larger than life personas throughout history?
There's some factors that I think you have to take into consideration when you're pondering that particular question. Factor one, Ouspensky, Bennett, and just about everybody else always had this way of describing Gurdjieff as being, appearing to be out of his environment no matter where he was. It was always just kind of, it was like he was transposed on the scene rather than a part of it. You could walk into the room and immediately recognize him. I think that's one portion that you would have to look at and really put into consideration. The other portion is he was a heavy vodka drinker and, from my understanding, indulged in women quite frequently. So he was in no way, shape, or form what we would typically consider to be someone of godliness.
Well,
you know, at least in the traditional sense.
You mean the traditional Christian sense?
I mean the traditional, I would say, white lighter sense. I mean, for a more broad stroke, I think when you're thinking of Buddhists or you're thinking of Christians or Jews or Muslims,
right.
Or any of the derivatives of them, they all seem to have the same idea that, you know, a prophet or someone of godliness is pure and in sync with his environment. And I think that's why I'm pointing out both factors, because he was neither in sync with his environment nor was he pure. As a matter of fact, he indulged very, very much like an everyday man.
Yeah.
One of the other things that was noted about Gurdjieff by Ospensky was the fact that no matter what type of work he was doing, he always seemed to just naturally come to it, like it was no big deal. If he was digging a 20-foot trench 8 feet deep, the man wouldn't break a sweat, and it didn't look like he wasn't enjoying it. He seemed to be able to put his mind into whatever he was doing.
Well, that's, yeah, that's a pretty powerful image.
That video, it's actually, there's not actually a terrible lot other than the narrative as far as audio goes throughout that black and white video, and I just searched YouTube and I can't seem to locate it off of, you know, off the whim. But when I find the name of it, I'll certainly, I'll repost it on this episode's page so that people in the future, when they're pulling the archive, will be able to at least track it down and take a look at it themselves and see what Ospensky thought of Gurdjieff.
Yeah, that's a good idea. I found a list of his books, and here's the one that you were reading. In 1933, he published The Herald of Coming Good. And it says here, later he withdrew it from publication because it did not have the desired effect. But, while difficult to read, it provides an invaluable perspective. He speaks about Tsvarno Harno, the subconscious, hypnotism, vanity, and his discovery that the force and degree of man's inner benevolence evokes in others a proportionate degree of ill will.
Does that seem that's a pretty good analysis. I think I'm actually at the part right now where we're indulging in that last little section.
Okay.
So, but that's a pretty good summation of what I'm reading. One of the most, I don't know, unusual ways that this book's been written is it's actually written in like a series of publications that have been bound together as a book. The first section is called My First Practical Counsel, and then the next section is a letter that he wrote in a Café de la Paris, which is in Paris. And then there's a circular letter, and then there's a supplementary announcement at the end of it. So he didn't sit down and actually, break out what he was going to put into this into one shot. I think that what Gurdjieff intended to do, and this is my understanding of it, he wanted to create a certain level of interest by publishing so many books that would be available to the public, and then beyond that, you actually had to come find him and join him to get a hold of any of the other literature that he had written. He very much was, trying to bait on the hook, so to speak. So I think when people are reading these books, they need to take the approach that there is a higher lesson beyond what's in these books. And I think that's where Ospensky and Bennett and all of them come into play. Because Gurdjieff himself wasn't going to make that publicly known. That was someone else's job. Somebody else's function. So, um, I guess we can call that a cue to an end of analysis. And what's next?
I found something kind of interesting here. It's on the same website, the GurdjieffLegacy.org. It's on the fourth way. It's called The Original Teachings. I'll just read it here. What has been confusing to many people is that until Gurdjieff introduced the teaching in Russia in 1912, it was not known. Since chronologically all teachings and religions appear before the fourth way, it is easily supposed that it is last. This perception, however, is quite linear. Though the fourth way does appear last, it is actually first. All esoteric and religious history is thus stood on its head. We see the world, as Gurdjieff said many times, topsy-turvy. Original does not mean newly invented, as it is often taken to mean. An original teaching is of the origin, meaning that the teaching existed first, from the beginning, before other teachings that may derive from it. In other words, the fourth way predates not only Christianity, but the Egyptian, Judaic, Persian, Buddhist, and Islamic religions. Gurdjieff tells us that the earliest indications of the teaching of the fourth way lie in prehistoric Egypt, an Egypt that existed before recorded history, which dates from 3000 BC. It will seem strange to many people, Gurdjieff said, when I say that the prehistoric Egypt was Christian many thousands of years before the birth of Christ. He said that the principles and ideas constituting true Christianity were known many thousands of years before the birth of Christ. In discovering these, he had the blueprints, so to say, of the original Christianity. As he said, the Christian church, the Christian form of worship, was not invented by the fathers of the church. It was all taken in a ready-made form from Egypt, only not from the Egypt we know, but from one which we do not know. This Egypt was in the same place as the other, but it existed much earlier.
Right. I've read that before, and I've actually taken that into consideration. There is a lot of parallels between Hermetic philosophies and what the Fourth Way teaches. And there's a ton of them, as a matter of fact. We've taken a look at alchemy in the past. We've taken a look at some of the other ideas, and I would say there's a strong resonance between them, and I believe for that reason that what Gurdjieff was stating about it being the original religion is in fact true.
Mm-hmm.
As I see it myself, you know, the very premise in which we approach ourselves is, you know, the beginning of everything that is religious or of religion. You know, everybody's reaching for this higher inner self, this, you know, heightened state of awakening, this evolution past the mundane mechanical man.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the things that the fourth way, and this is, again, my humble opinion, but one of the things that the fourth way is really trying to teach you is not to break away from the machine, but to recognize, understand, and utilize the machine, to know how to drive the car rather than to just be inside the car driving.
Right. That's very interesting. I would go one step further and say that once a person has figured out how to use his machine effectively, eventually he can, you know, using that analogy, he can drive to his destination and then get out of the car and enjoy the fruits of his journey and no longer become or be a machine. So I think it's in stages and it's in steps. You gotta, crawl before you can walk, and you gotta walk before you can run. That's sort of a different analogy. I don't want to get into a mixed metaphor here, but you know, you have to realize that you're a machine and you have to learn how to use your machine correctly. And then, you know, years later, I think you can become not so much a machine, but a living conscious being. And then you become a master. And then
I think
the different things are possible than when you first start learning the work and understanding it.
Forgive me, Avenger, but I think you maybe go a little too far in that, in the fact that the machine, as it's described and it's demonstrated, is merely the point of perception, the point of interaction. It's like the monitor of your computer screen, I suppose. You know, without utilizing the machine, you can't see what's beyond the self. You know,
I agree. But I think once we've worked through all those problems and issues, I think ourselves as well as the work in itself can evolve to a new level. And I think in that new level, things become a whole lot less mechanical and a whole lot more organic and conscious.
I guess all I can really say to that is that I hope that you're absolutely correct. I completely.
I do too. I think I am. I guess I would be surprised if men like Gurdjieff and Ouspensky and Maurice Nicol and others were no more than highly intuitive or self-sufficient machines. I think they were able to break away from that and become something else. And that's what I hope to do too.
Sure. I mean, these men, they dropped everything in their lives, so absolutely everything in their lives, and they pursued nothing but the work from the point of from the point of acceptance of that being who they were on. Matter of fact, one of the things that video was talking about and was Ouspensky, after originally meeting Gurdjieff, went back to the working world for about a year and a half or so. And then after that, he just found that he could no longer be successful functioning on that level, that he needed to devote the rest of his existence to doing this particular work. And I mean, now they've given us a lot of groundwork that wasn't there before, but my question is, if they didn't transcend then, being able to dedicate that much time to it, you know, how does a person who has to maintain, you know, some grounded footing, how did they achieve? How did they go past? You know, when you have to consistently return every day to the, you know, the mundane machine, you know, how do you ever maintain a prolonged period of enlightenment?
Okay. So your question is, like, how do maintain or prolong it? Is that the essence of your question, or?
No, the essence of my question is, these men dedicated their entire lives to this
right.
working, and nothing
right.
else existed beyond that. How does a man such as myself, who has to work a 9-to-5 because I have children to provide for, even attempt to strive for the levels of enlightenment that they reached, given that I have to consistently keep running back down the stairs?
Well, I think that's the real world is the laboratory, and it's where all the experiments go. And the real world is also the classroom, and is where we You know, we teach and learn, you know, everything there is to know and to have to do with the work. So I think, like I said before, you know, you can't successfully understand the fourth way by just sitting quietly in a room and meditating or contemplating your entire life, because then you're not ready when you go out in the world, which is full of drama and chaos and, you know, distractions and obstacles and this and that. So the real world is where you have to learn it. And but I think there is something to be said for working alone and completely isolated. I think that's very difficult to do. I think that's easy to lose track. However, I do think it's possible for individuals that know about the work and practice it and have a sincere conviction to become something else, something better. I think they can work alone. I think that is possible. You know, I don't think you, once you get a basic understanding, I don't think you need an esoteric school to find enlightenment, or awakening or Buddhahood or, you know, being like Christ or Gurdjieff or whatever you want to call it. So I think anything is possible. It just, you know, it just depends. It depends on the person and their level of determination. And so I don't think outside, you know, I think if you, you know, it doesn't matter if you live in Arkansas or if you live here in Wisconsin or somewhere in Europe or if you're in a wheelchair or if you're a millionaire or if you're a normal middle class, 9-to-5 kind of guy, I think, or a man or a woman, I think all that stuff doesn't really matter as much.
Well, I'll completely agree with you. And there was actually a underlined idea that I was trying to push with my question. And the idea is that I think that Gurdjieff's intent when he brought this fourth way over with him was to give the man who has to return to, you know, the everyday, a tool to continue working. As a matter of fact, I believe that a lot of the exercises that he had his pupils or students doing on a regular basis were demonstrations of existing within the mundane world and still maintaining that level of self-observation.
Yeah.
I think that a lot of the keys to this whole mystery is the understanding that it's really all about how you're interacting with others. Mm. You know, being conscious of your role, your place, your part of what you're doing.
Yeah. I can remember some of my earliest struggles with myself after encountering the work. And that was as simple and as difficult as keeping quiet when I was working with my dad and we'd be working together in the same car, going from place to place, doing jobs and whatever we had to. And he would drive, and I was, I don't know, somewhere in my mid-20s, I guess. And I would force myself to, you know, most of the time, unless I had something nice to say or something funny, just sit there and not say anything. Because he would do little things, you know, as fathers sometimes do, to irritate me, or, you know, I wasn't happy exactly with the way he drove. You know, I'm a leader. I like to lead. I like to be in charge or do my own thing. I'm very much an individual. I don't really like to follow anyone. And in that circumstance, I did have to follow, and it wasn't getting me anywhere to bring up the fact that, you know, oh, I would have done that differently. You know, I would have gotten out of the parking lot different way, or driving too fast, or you're driving too slow, or you could have made that stoplight and you didn't even try, and things like that. So I forced myself to not say anything, not to express negative emotions, to not place myself first and consider myself before considering him, and just creating more drama and chaos and nonsense in my life. So I physically forced myself to not say anything, even though I wanted to say, you know, I wanted to criticize, or I wanted to, you know, I was unhappy with something, and I wanted to vent, I wanted to get it out of my system, and, I don't know, infect him, or infect our conversation, or whatever. And I had to force myself not to. It was very difficult to just sit there and not say what I wanted to say. But I think that's one of the essential things of the work, is you have to do not what you want, but what is necessary. You know, all the time we're trying to do things that we want to, like, I don't know, eating hot dogs and ice cream every day, or drinking to excess, or even smoking a lot, or, you know, doing drugs, or, you know, not paying attention, or just watching TV all of our lives, you know, things like that. That's what we want to do. But instead of doing what we want to do, what we desire, you know, we got to kind of have to man up and do what is necessary to change. And that takes work. And it takes struggling with your own self to, you know, to not do what is accustomed to you, to not do what you feel like doing every second of the day. You know, just do what you have to do. And it's a very rigorous, very structured, you know, you got to deny yourself something. Sometimes it's as easy as denying yourself suffering, although that in itself is very difficult. So anyway, I just wanted to share that. And that's it.
For our listeners, you might maybe illustrate why it was so important to achieve that silence during the time that you were spending with your dad.
Why was it necessary?
Why was it necessary, yes.
Okay. It was necessary because to not do that, to not keep silent, was, you know, that's just the normal way I was living my life. And that's the normal way that many people live their life. And it's a very mechanical existence. A thought comes in your head and you act on it. That, you know, that nothing could be simpler. Yet nothing could also be more wrong. Because to live that way, it's like you're not living. You're not in control. You're just some automaton being controlled by whatever fleeting drives come into you. You know, whatever the universe has in store for you, that's what you end up doing. Whatever one eye inside you, one of yourselves, thinks, you know, you say, and then the next minute, a different eye comes into play and wants you to do something else. And as long as you carry on this chaos and this drama, you can't actually observe yourself. You can't work on yourself. You have to stop doing what you're doing, physically, emotionally, and intellectually, and really observe yourself and change and not do things in a mechanical way, not put yourself first all the time, and not express whatever negative emotions you have, not identify with whatever you're seeing or experiencing or feeling. You know, you have to separate yourself. And yeah, so all those things are definitely necessary if you want to get somewhere in the work. And if you do, then, you know, you have to take certain drastic actions, which seems simple, like being silent and not criticizing someone, or not being derogatory to them, or, you know, not showing off. But it's really difficult. It's really hard to do. especially when it's new to you. After a while, you know, it became more easy than it did at first. You know, if he would go the wrong way because he forgot that we were going somewhere else first, you know, my first inclination might have been to be like, God, dumbass, like, why'd you do that? And really, you know, what does that help? That doesn't help anything. That just creates more suffering and more drama and more chaos in the world. And it just furthers the illusion that we all live in. But if you take a different course and you stop yourself and you either don't say anything or you say, you know, maybe he'll say like, oh yeah, I forgot that. You know, we're going here instead of there. And you're like, oh, it's okay. Everybody forgets things, you know, no big deal. Then, I don't know, then you changed something in yourself. You became, for a short time, a different person, a more conscious person, and less mechanical. So, in essence, I guess that's my answer, why it's necessary.
Excellent answer. I don't think that I could have... I don't think that I could have said it so eloquently, so...
Oh, well, thank you. do you have any, I don't know, personal moments or experiences in your own life where you struggled against yourself or against some other obstacle when bringing the work into your life?
Well, actually... what I'd like to reflect upon is the work actually being in my life prior to my knowledge of its existence even being there. As a young man, I had a terrible, terrible temper, a very, very bad temper, and it was very easily set off. And it hit a point where it was pretty much going to force me down a road of self-destruction. I was going to push everybody that I loved and everything that I loved as far away from me as I possibly could. And in the end, end up isolating myself. And well, obviously, there's no reason to be alive at that point. And so I spent a lot of hours in meditation and in just self-observance trying to suppress this anger every time it wanted to come out. And I think that's as good of an illustration as any as to what the, you know, real effect here that we're trying to get to is, you know, getting that temper, that demon, as I called it, in check and under my control, you know, deciding when it was appropriate to use it versus letting it decide when it wanted to come out. You know, those were highly functioning things.
Oh, that's great that you discovered that about yourself and were able to do something about it even before you were introduced to Gurdjieff and the work. And I would guess that after being exposed to all that, esotericism, it became either easier for you or you were able to bring other elements of self-control into your life.
Absolutely. I would say that each period of my life has given me an obstacle of myself that I've had to bring into control. And, you know, through different studies, different practices, different attempts, I finally will master each one. Each one giving me a good, firm understanding of a different philosophy, the few that I have followed throughout my life. But each one's pinnacle being the ability to control or decide when to, you know, engage different mechanics in myself. The work, as I've been studying it now for some time, the work seems to be a nice set of tools for a person to to do this without having to struggle in the ways that I've had to struggle. And by struggle, I don't mean that you're not going to have to still work towards, making the change. What I mean is that I had to figure out how I was going to make the change without, anything in front of me to demonstrate a method or way.
Right. Yeah, I think it's easier if you have some sort of structure. And I think that's what the work provides. It's a means to an end. And it's set out for you, what you have to do.
Correct. You just have to be careful when you're doing these things that you don't allow them to become mechanical themselves.
Right. Yeah, I think if someone is really sincere about it and works with others, I think that's very doable. That's an easy hurdle to get over. But if you're not fully sincere or if you're not working with other people in the beginning, I think it's easy to take things the wrong way. And for what should be conscious activities becoming mechanical. That's definitely something that people need to be mindful of.
Absolutely. Sorry, taking a moment just to respond in the chat room.
Okay. What's going on in the chat room?
We've got Pansof hanging out. He's been listening most of the show. And, we were just talking back and forth.
Okay.
So, just, trying to be a good host as well as attend to my duties on the air.
It's not an easy task, is it?
It can be difficult at times. I'm just happy it's only one person at a time I'm trying to deal with.
Yeah.
If it was multiple people in the chat room and multiple people on the phone, that's usually when I have a splitting headache come the end of the show. So.
Yeah. Well, this is, at a different website called Gurdjieff.org under the teaching. There's something that I wanted to read. Then what precisely was Gurdjieff's teaching? Although the question seems to promise clarification, it is spoiled by its very rigor. Time deadens authorized versions like Hemlock, and Gurdjieff never issued one. I teach, he said gnomically, that when it rains, the pavement gets wet. The vivifying power of his ideas entails the moment, the circumstance, the type, and state of the people. His one constant demand is know thyself, to which he adduces a metaphysic, a metapsychology, and a metachemistry, which absolutely defy precis. Blah, 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 goes on. But I think that's a very powerful thing, at least for me to end on, regarding Gurdjieff. I teach that when it rains, the pavements get wet. I think if you really look at it, that it kind of says it all.
I have to agree with that. I was actually digging through the last couple of pages that I was reading, trying to actually look for something to read, but it appears we actually only have about 90 seconds left in the show. So I guess on that note, man, good look into Gurdjieff, and definitely a lot better insight as to what the fourth way is all about that's been painted here today before you guys.
Yeah. When I finally get that stupid book, I'll talk about it briefly some other show. But for now, I think we covered it pretty well, and I guess that's all she wrote.
Absolutely. And in that case, everybody have a great day, and we'll see you next week.
Thank you for listening to The Use. Opinions expressed by our guests or callers do not necessarily reflect those held by Venture or Beast or any institution associated with us. The Use does not condone any illegal or unethical acts. If you have been offended during the production of the show, we're sorry, but as the old expression goes, tough luck. Thank you, and see you next week.